This is Don't to Brass Tacks. You're on the air. Good morning. Don't to Brass Tacks. Good morning, Don't to Brass Tacks.
Hello, good morning, Lisa Gale. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm doing well. Yourself?
I am well. This is Crystal Austin.
Crystal, how are you?
Former political candidate or recent political candidate. How are you? I'm well.
I'm doing good, thanks.
Yes, I just wanted to weigh in on these terminations, and I believe that it is quite unfortunate that there has been a lack of empathy in some instances where persons have been told verbally that they're going home without being given a specific date, for example, and persons feeling as though the way how the message was conveyed about them no longer being required was quite insensitive on the part of the person doing the termination.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to challenge the civil service, because it is clear that this is not going to be the end. The restructuring will continue into the next financial year, with the state-owned enterprises being the core focus. So I think it is incumbent on the civil service and the human resources managers within the public service to have some training done for themselves so that they can execute any future layoffs in a more empathetic manner.
Yes.
And in so doing, for themselves as well, because I can't imagine how they feel having to convey such horrible news to persons in this economic climate. But if they're going to have to do it, and it is indeed one of the duties of persons in human resources at some stage or the other in your career, you're going to have to convey that bad news. Mm-hmm. They need to have the appropriate training. It feels as though some persons were asked to give the news and they were not necessarily prepped for the approach. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they lack the requisite empathy. Perhaps they were afraid that maybe they were next, or their names were later on down the list. I'm not exactly sure what emotions they're going through right now, but certainly this whole process seems to have had a lack of empathy at some stages and in some pockets of the civil service. So that is something that needs to be done.
Well, that's one of the elements. With respect to empathy, the other scenario has to do with following the right process. You don't verbally send a person home, and that was not the expectation of the public servants, who would have heard the Prime Minister the previous Sunday talk about the impending layoffs, and the commitment was there's going to be a preparation time one. So that when you are told, you would also get your check at the same time. There's not a promise of layoff, because you know what, that can spiral. A person can then automatically go through a significant level of stress, go on sick leave, and then that can actually stymie the success, if for lack of a better word. That can stymie the actual process of the layoffs in that particular office, because you know you can't hand somebody a letter when they're on sick leave. So that could be a challenge. You were making another point?
Yeah, that being said, I think that we have bandied about the term public sector reform for a very long time, but have never really meaningfully gone about the exercise. And what we're seeing here is really public sector reform in action. A lot of the changes that are being made now also, from a political perspective, need to be made at this time. Making them close to an election, for example, would be political suicide.
Yes,
we are a few months after the last election. If any smart government wants to implement an austerity program, the best time to do it is as close as possible following winning the election. And this government has received a significant mandate from the people of Barbados. Mm-hmm. A lot of what they have identified as mission critical are being reflected now in the policies that they're implementing, and it makes sense to do the hard things now with the view and hopefully everything will go according to plan, because regardless of what political party or political affiliation you have, this is Barbados that we're talking about. So the idea really is that we will see progress and we will see benefits in the short term and in the medium to long term, so that by the next election, Barbadians can say they're seeing the fruits of what is being done now. And I'm speaking purely from a political, analytical perspective.
Also from a communications, a crisis, you're a communications specialist. And one of the things you would have observed is that there was not the right, the proper way in which information was communicated. And therefore, you're bringing attention to that. And I'm sure a number of the leaders within the public service, i.e. permanent secretaries and heads of departments, ought to continue professional training, because they are dealing with people. They might be trained in, let's say they're trained in geology or trained in even public service, but they may not, or foreign affairs, or, you know, some specific area, but they may not have been trained in HR nor in IR. And therefore, then they may bundle a new policy, and as they execute, that may have a negative impact on the same policymakers who are looking there, as they say, to do something fit for purpose or make the public service more reformed to 21st century or something. So the call for further training, particularly in crisis communication or in HR, is a good call.
Yes, I agree with you. I think another acronym you mentioned, HR, Human Resources, IR, Industrial Relations. Another acronym is EI, Emotional Intelligence.
That's right, that's right.
Which really helps you in managing
dealing with people, essentially. Your emotions and dealing with other people.
In those difficult circumstances. I don't want to jump off of this topic without stating again how important it is for empathy to be demonstrated. Because I don't think we could really avoid what we're going through right now any longer. We would have delayed and delayed and delayed these very difficult choices, and now we're here. So the ideal scenario would be that there's empathy. And while I understand the frustration of a lot of persons who are saying, you know, in one breath you were hearing Mia Kiris, and then in the next breath, you know, you're being terminated. The fact of the matter is that Barbados really has fallen very, very far on too many of the important international indices in terms of our economic performance and our ability to deliver those sacred social services. So much deterioration has taken place, and in order for us to redeem where we are now, where we've been downgraded into oblivion, very, very difficult choices have to be made. The other point I wanted to make is that I keep hearing people saying that one of the problems they have with the current administration is that there are all these consultants. And we use the word consultants in a very derogatory way. As a consultant myself, I often cringe, because it's very similar to how people refer to politicians in a very derogatory way. But it is not in and of itself the profession that is bad, but a few bad apples that really have spoiled the reputation of Peter, Paul, and all. So let's look at the role of the consultant from a theoretical perspective. When a company hires someone to consult, often they're bringing expertise to the table that is not already available in the organization. That person is being hired for a specific period, and they're expected to bring some kind of knowledge, training, proprietary information that can help improve the organization and leave it better once they have departed. One of the other things a consultant can do that internal employees cannot do is they can speak frankly without fear or favor about things that are wrong within an organization. So when a company hires a consultant, it is not some kind of patronage or political loyalty that people seem to only associate the term consultant with. Largely, it is about bringing in that expertise, getting those best practices, especially in the public service where change is very iterative and we are not very quick to evolve and improve on the way how we do things. That consultant, who we love to hate, has the critical role of helping to modernize those practices and help improve efficiency and effectiveness within an organization. Now, the extent to which they are compensated, which is at the heart of a lot of people's growth, really comes down to the negotiation between the company and the consultant. In certain professions, like the legal profession, there are legislative or legislation
parameters. Around that. Yeah, legislative parameters for it.
People can be compensated. But by and large, it comes down to a negotiation between the private individual, the consultant, and the company that is hiring them.
However, I hear you, and as you quite rightly said in your prefix, you said in the theoretical sense, but there are many instances right here in Barbados and within the Caribbean region where persons have been hired and have been given titles of the term consultant and have consulted, and the public of Barbados has not seen what they have brought to the table, and they have been handsomely awarded with some lovely sums, and therefore people have, as you quite rightly said, the reputation then, Peter pays for Paul and Paul pays for all, and that's why you would find so many people treating consultants as though they are these politically appointed persons and not experts in their particular field that are bringing specific and good information, and not just information, but they're bringing about a change that is needed for the organization that for which they've been hired.
Yes, and that's where transparency in leadership and management comes in, and that's where integrity and honesty in business comes in. And I'm not saying that there are not instances like the ones you described, but everyone who works in the profession of consulting or as a management consultant or a specialist consultant is not out there trying
to hoodwink
companies. Okay. There are many of us who genuinely are willing and interested in assisting businesses with being better off once we have
made an intervention,
transacted or delivered our recommendations or implemented whatever remedial policies we put forward. So I also wanted to highlight the fact that where you have persons now on the breadline, everyone is talking about entrepreneurship. But consulting is entrepreneurship. You're trading in knowledge. You're trading a service. And many of these persons also then turn around and hire subcontractors, creating employment in the economy.
Yep.
Then on top of that, they are on contracts most of the time. There are very few retainers going around in this economic climate. So they are not in the same position as someone with a staunch job who can go forward to the bank easily and get a mortgage or a land loan or even a business loan. So there are some downsides to the practice as well. It is not only about people getting big fat checks. Those are the ones that get all the publicity in the media because it suits that agenda. But that is only a small fraction of those who are out there diligently trying to bring, again, cutting-edge knowledge, best practice, to help businesses in instances where persons with rigid job descriptions are not able to stretch beyond their existing job scope to bring the type of change that is needed. That's why companies should legitimately bring that type of practitioner in-house. So that's my contribution.
Okay.
I know some people will probably call in a cuss and quarrel and say, you know, there's still too many consultants or whatever, and that's their right. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to put in perspective that when a company brings in that type of external expertise, if you already have an HR manager, for example, and you bring in an external consultant in HR, that external person has to be bringing something additional else to the table, yes, that your existing team or resources do not have, but that your company needs.
Yes.
And in so doing, they should leave some types of systems in place that they do not need to be paid on a long-term basis, mm-hmm, but that your internal people can then take over and run with those.
Knowledge sharing factors should take place.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your contribution, Ms. Crystal Austin. This is Dr. Brass Stacks. Dr. Brass Stacks, good morning.
Yeah. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, sir.
There are a few things I want to talk about, but I want to know if there's any truth that they're thinking about privatizing public transportation. Because if they do, to me, that would be an act of madness. We have had a problem with PSVs. If it's not 40 or past 40 years, it's almost 40 years. And we cannot get it solved. Any person who has the slightest common sense would rethink and rethink before they even consider privatizing transportation. It isn't who owned them, it's who be operating them. Right? Instance, what is going to happen to the elderly? That's one. We have had cases when we have bad weather, when you cannot get a PSV van early. Let's say sometimes as early as 1 or 2 o'clock. People know what? Right? When the radio talk was being spoken about, one of the excuses given was we listen to news. They're going to tell us about 9 PSVs on the road. They can guarantee that $8.75 sitting on the radio. That is a fact. We have transport board workers that have got bad weather who work well into the night. They have families too. Show me the radio and the transport board back. This is one thing that I'm not going to support the government of Barbados on. You're going to expose the elderly and the vulnerable.
I mean, you're implicitly suggesting that if private sector were to take over, whether in whole or in part, that they would leave out the elderly. You're making some assumptions there that may not be real. Why would you come to that conclusion?
They are real. You have a person who comes on the radio from ATO, and he gives the public the impression about certain things, and he know it isn't because he has witnessed on more than one occasion the foolishness that's being done. And no matter how much I challenge him to come on a call-in program with me, he would not take up the challenge. He would not. I don't want to go and talk behind his back. I want the two of us to be on the phone together, and we all be students together. I have the facts. Mm-hmm. I don't need your evidence. You can misplace evidence. You can alter evidence. You can destroy it. You cannot do anything with facts other than face them. Right? Mm. I see it signs up every day. Up to Saturday.
So you're against any form of private sector, privatization, or what about partial privatization?
None. What should happen? The management of transport board need to be changed. That is the problem.
You said that before, and it has happened.
Yes, and I will keep on saying it. It happened.
It has happened.
Changing the board and changing the chairman isn't the change they want. That the change they want, it go deeper than that. And not only transport board, other government agencies, it is management that got us in this. And besides the decisions of a former government, it is bad, but we have a habit. When we reach these kind of stages, we send home the maid, the bus driver, the janitor. That's the point you expect, man. We don't send home the people that really want sending home. We don't touch them. So when you allow those people to come into a new government with the same attitude, you expect anything different. It can't be different. It can't. And in the meantime, innocent, hardworking people are being penalized. I'm not saying that some people don't have to be sent home. I'm not even saying that some don't deserve to be sent home. But a lot of them are innocent victims. And that got me angry. angry.
Legitimately so. Down to brass tacks.
Hey, good afternoon. Good morning, sorry. Bear of bad news. You only feel pain when it hurts you.
That's not true.
Oh? So if you don't feel pain, if you're not hurting, how can you feel pain?
Empathy. Have you ever had see a child's finger squeezed in a door?
And if it's your child, you feel it too, let me tell.
But you just said that if you don't feel
pain. And you also feel it because you're going to have to pay for the repairs of the finger.
No, don't study the repairs. You feel pain when you see somebody grimacing, crying, or whatsoever. That's what empathy is. You put yourself in that person's place, and you feel their pain on their behalf. That's what empathy is.
Well, I suppose, you know, in terms of the definition, you're probably spot on. But if I am also responsible for that pain, how am I going to feel empathy? I'm the one who's responsible. I'm the one who made the decision. How am I going to feel empathy? How am I going to feel part of that pain?
Sometimes you do. If I have
so
a company.
You've been in that position before and you've done that. You've actually advised that to happen in the company. So therefore, you know what it's like to feel pain because of a decision that was made as a result of the advice that you gave. That's what you're saying to me.
I'm saying to you, very similar to what you just surmised, that when you are also the bearer of the bad news, you can also experience empathy simultaneously. Even although you are the person who made the recommendation that can have that particular impact on the person. Yes, that's what I'm saying.
But that empathy would be most certainly tailored.
No.
It would be tempered on a realization that the decision that you made was one of a number of other decisions. But when there were alternatives and you chose one over others, surely that empathy would not be as strong as if you were left in a position where it was the only one you could have taken.
I don't share your perspective, but I understand where you're coming from.
Well, the problem is if, as always, if you are concerned with cost, then you tackle all of the costs before you decide to do the one that is most hurtful for many. There are decisions that can be made, and somewhere along, no matter what decision you make, somebody is going to be dissatisfied with the decision.
Agreed.
If that person is going to be a private sector person, mm-hmm. Well, there only will be probably one or two of them or four of them. But if you're going to make a decision that will affect employees or particularly the ones at the bottom, because the further down you go, the further down on the totem pole you go, the more people will be affected. Because you deal with cost.
I was reading this book 2 days ago.
If I wanted to hurt people, I'd rather hurt fewer people than hurt more. You know, that's how I think of it. You see, I'm sorry, but that's me. I mean, I feel empathy too. But my empathy is multiplied by the numbers of people. Mm-hmm. No, sorry, I didn't mean to cross you.
That's all right. I was sharing with you, which I was crossing. I was saying just about 3 days ago I was going through. I was recommending this book for a colleague of mine. And I went through, just brisking through a few just to determine which was the best book. And I came upon this gentleman who wrote a book in the 1800s. And he was talking about the term efficiency. And remember we had our last conversation about that.
You obviously have not forgotten. That
wasn't the tickle. The tickle was more, he was talking about utility and efficiency. He's an economist from way back. And he was making the point that economists think more in terms of utility. What he was really looking at was the different schools of thought that influence your decision making. So you just made the point that if somebody's looking at just cutting costs, they're only going to think cost, they're not going to think empathy, etc.
And if we
add the human element to the profession, of course the empathy would come in. But I thought of you. I remember the gentleman when you came on.
I got broad shoulders and a nice, pretty face, and like really handsome, you're tall. So if you think of me, I hope you're thinking of the right things.
Okay.
Lisa, here's the thing. You are managing and the affairs of people.
Yes.
The affairs of people. I don't believe it is true because I'm like Gonzales, Mr. Prime Minister Gonzales, who believes that when it comes to public office, public resources, if you may choose the economist term, it's not about profiting. It is about at least covering your costs. All right. I mean, I don't think government entities should be turning a profit every year unless those profits cover the costs of previous losses. All right. That's all. That's all it is. It's not about showing that you're viable and then you can sell it off to some private sector person. You're concerned with costs, not numbers. There is a policy that government should adopt, and that is the private sector will never be able to employ all Barbadians. In fact, the way private sector is going nowadays, it's going to find reasons to let Barbadians go. You know, the ATMs have replaced a number of tellers, and soon artificial intelligence will come in there that will replace all of the call centers in Barbados and overseas, and a number of other areas where automation will most certainly put people Barbados on the breadline. If the political parties cannot see part of their agenda as using public funds to at least maintain a viable consumer base by employing people, even if you got to cut salaries at the top, let's keep people employed. I mean, having a clean street, you got a lot of maintenance work to be done. We knock down derelict buildings, cut down grass, all keep people. I don't agree with the army, make them to do kind of work like that there. That is what the government should be part of. It has to be a policy of the government. Then there would be no need about, you know, this thing about sending home people, particularly from the bottom, because you're affecting that particular statistic, that particular agenda. And I cannot understand why, in God's name, can the union not come forward and say, why are you cutting staff before you start cutting other costs? But yeah, it's a simple, straightforward
argument. You notice
why,
that.
Why are you cutting staff?
You notice that the commentary from the union was not anti-job loss. It was more about how it is being done.
And the fact because, targeting women on kind
of because at the level of the social partnership, they all agreed, private sector, the unions, and the government of Barbados agreed that the wage bill was too high. And then they went about using varying tactics. How are we going to execute on these new objectives in order to bring our economy back to a particular state of well-being? So I'm hearing you, but you seem to be at the first negotiation.
But
the first consultation. We are past that. The decision is persons will have to go home.
Yeah.
It is how we go about doing that, and also how do we manage post those persons' departure.
That should never have been the result.
So you disagree then with the policy of job losses?
Of course, big time. Okay. Because, and the people that you're sending home are the ones who are least capable of starting some new enterprise or something that would actually be, you know, provide some kind of meaningful employment, unless they go and be vendor on the side of the street. It cannot be. I mean, there was no thought that went into that. Yes, I'm disappointed with the trade unions, but I'm also disappointed with both political parties because they seem not to accept that the L in their name represents labor. And they have been so anti-labor over the past 25 or 30 years that it's remarkable that they're still continuing with that particular L, even though I know the L means I'm indifferent, but that's between you and me. So here's the thing, okay? I'm talking fast again. Here's the thing. There is the issue of costs that still need to be understood. We need to know what these costs are. They're going to send home X amount of people now. Okay, stop. Don't send home no more yet. Let me get to the issue where you demonstrate to the public that these other costs are also important. I'm not talking about transfers, because transfer is just an accounting issue where one prime minister wants to take them off book. But the cost to government is all the same. Transfer or not, if you still need the people, keep them on. I'll find a way to keep them on. Don't send home no more public service. Let me see where your other costs are. Let us see where how much you're paying in rent, for argument's sake. Can you not cut that back? Can you not remove that? Let us see what you're paying executives for their different, for all the various little perks that they have. Can they not sacrifice their perks for the time being, even if the fund is set up to make sure that their student fund is still operational and their second mortgages can still be paid for? Find ways that you can help everyone maintain some kind of employment. You know, because I have people who will go pass through my door. See, the public service don't support me. Ordinary Barbadians do pass through my door. I pay a little thing at the door, I come through. When you send their people home, well, I ain't got nobody coming through my door no more. I can't go and beg the senior public service. Why don't they support me for change? Huh? You need to have consumers in order for other types of operations to operate. And if you cannot see the public service as being a major contributor to the consuming body of Barbados, you are wrong.
Okay. Thank you so much. This is Dr. Brass Tacks. Dr. Brass Tacks, good morning. It's now 11:29. You're on the air.
Good morning, Miss Gale.
Good morning, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Okay. Now, Miss Gale, I need you to help me with a couple of hookups, like, or something I don't understand. Now, first of all, let's deal with the IMF.
With the?
IMF.
Okay.
Yeah. Can you help me? What Barbados, at the moment, produces that we could get us of all financial trouble right now with the IMF on all those debts?
What they produce?
What Barbados, in other words, my Let me tell you what I meant when I say that. I believe any country going into any arrangement with the IMF, they should have products. They should have things that the world needs that they could sell. Oh. Whereby,
even a resource scarce country that has sought the assistance of the IMF, you think that they should come up with resources?
Do you know any country in the world that entered the IMF? Like how Barbados now have entered?
There are several countries that
went. What is Barbados producing that we need the IMF to push for us on the world market that could help us?
But the IMF isn't a push. Let me just share with you the role of the IMF. The intervention for IMF is to provide balance of payment support.
Balance of payment.
How you know that we are having, and I think you're asking these questions knowing the answer or trying to be difficult. But let me answer you nicely. The International Monetary Fund, for which Barbados is a member and has been for several decades, has been called on to provide funding at very low interest rates to assist Barbados in its crisis that it is experiencing right now. There are several countries that have shown positives, having entered into a relationship with the International Monetary Fund. And there are some countries a couple decades ago that continue to reel from their relationship with the International Monetary Fund. There have been changes over the years with the ethos of the IMF. And we have one very close to home example with a country that has chosen to use IMF funds, and they're experiencing now 5% growth, and that's Grenada. And that intervention is very recent, within the last 5 years.
May I continue?
Sure.
Now, Miss Gill, this is the problem that I have. Barbados is a very expensive country. See, like, for instance, Guyana, that I think last year produced something like 250,000 tons of sugar. And and a larger number in rice, they have something to sell to the world. If places like Guyana could enter an IMF program and find it so difficult to get out, how Barbados can get out this year?
Guyana entered into an IMF program and found it difficult to get out. You know that Guyana is experiencing 12.1% growth as we speak.
But this is the problem I have.
No. You just said it can't get out. So are you trying to figure out which Guyana is this?
Is Guyana out?
Guyana is experiencing 12.1% growth.
Okay, Ms. Gill, let me get to make it. Because these figures and talk,
no, but you just made a statement. You just made a statement that said Guyana cannot get out.
Okay. When Guyana released their sugar to the world with their dollar at $100-something to US dollar, you believe Guyana is getting really what the world?
No, don't change your subject. You made a statement.
No, you are giving me the impression, and I'm hearing it on the radio all the time, how good Jamaica is doing, how Guyana is doing. If you was working for $250 a week and you get a 20% increase, you do well. But the fella getting $2,000 a week and get 2%, who's better off? The percentage don't mean that you're better off. What I'm saying is this here. I am a Barbadian. I live here. I know I'm not saying I'm going to die in Barbados because you don't know. But I'm saying I would like the best for Barbados. But to fool me, not you directly, don't get me, that I mean you, that this agreement that we have with the IMF, this is about 40 years of trouble. Because I can tell you why. And I can start from here. In 1992, 1993, and 1994, a former prime minister that ended up very unpopular explained to us at that time that we have to do things because we are going the wrong road. And I keep hearing people repeating only one part of what he said, how we get back here. But I'm saying this. For those who know not put me in this IMF program, most of the departments or statutory boards and wherever they're going and laying off people, check who introduced them to this country after hearing the Prime Minister telling us that we cannot live like this. We cannot employ the amount of people on the government purse. And he didn't only cut your salary at the time. He's telling more people to show Barbadians the government cannot employ this number of people. The Lord Erskine Stanley first did that in the early 90s. In come a government that the government ministers and their supporters want to give the people of Barbados the impression that the problem Barbados is going through now is because of the last 10 years. Barbados' problem now is because the former government of the late 90s and early 2000s and now decided to play too much politics and wanted to show people that we are the best in the Caribbean. We could borrow as we like. We could sell everything that all the Tom Baddons help us with. And now people want to say, oh, it only started 10 years ago. Isn't it a 10-year thing? And let me say this to you, Ms. Gill. The IMF is here. And we're getting $49 million, I think, every 6 months. What $49 million could do to Barbados, Ms. Gill? You got me?